welcome to the Hope Show, Gabfest. Myself and Michael talking about punk rock and picking our 10 songs that defined punk in a certain era or a certain year. So we're up to 1979 now. Can't believe we're up there already. And we're having nice conversations about what songs we should be playing for each year. It's proven a bit of a challenge, isn't it, Michael?
It doesn't get any easier now. Like this is brutal. It would have been much easier to pick 450 punk songs that we love, but something really interesting happens when you're just confined to 10 a year. It's very condensed. It's very concentrated. But then it also, you're seeing the whole history of punk and where it went and how it mutated. So we've made it hard on ourselves, but yeah, that's how we've lived our lives.
Yeah. And I know we got a little bit of stick over some songs being left over, and somebody actually gave us a whole playlist of songs that we should have had included in 1978 last week. And I'm sure we're in for a bit more stick this week. But again, you know, the way this works, just for people listening, is that, you know, we kind of come up with five songs each, or if we've overlaps, we you know, add some more songs in. So anyone else doing it could pick a different set of songs entirely. But these are songs that kind of mean something, and songs that we think meant something to punk rock as it evolves. And as you say, it is very interesting to hear how the sound is changing. So it's kind of nice and a bit of fun to pick these out, isn't it?
That's brilliant, Brent. It's been, you know, such great fun, but really, really fascinating as well. Like I'm surprised constantly when you think, oh, that came before that, or yeah, that single came out the same year as this other one.
Yeah. So we'll kickstart the show then tonight. First song tonight is Black Flag, Nervous Breakdown. We play it and we chat about it then after.
I'm about to have a nervous breakdown. My head really hurts. If I don't find a way out of here, I'm gonna go to circus. I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Head on my shoulder. The same old lines. Don't tell me that today. If you know what's good for you, you'll get out of my way, 'cause I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Head on my shoulders, going faster. I won't apologize for acting out of line. You see the way I am. You leave anytime you die, 'cause I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Head on my shoulders, going faster. Crazy, crazy.
So that's Black Flag, Nervous Breakdown, SST Records, their own label. Taking DIY really, and the whole DIY work ethic to a completely new level, Michael.
To me, Black Flag aren't just a brilliant music story, they're a brilliant business story. And America hated punk rock. People should never forget how much America, you know, the mainstream America, music industry America, absolutely thought that this was dreadful. This was a really, really awful moment in music history. So punk rock was really suppressed by the music industry in the States. And to me, Nervous Breakdown, it's the sound of people melting down their 7-inch singles of My Sharona by The Knack, which was, you know, far and away one of the worst songs ever recorded, one of the worst songs ever put on vinyl, a cheap, weird, odd people. I think most of the people who like that song haven't listened to the lyrics, and they might have heard it hundreds of times. It's, you know, for that to be an ad for a burger chain with the context of it, with the objectification of women. If you look at the sleeve of that, it's pure sleaze. So to me, Nervous Breakdown is the sound of people melting down their Knack singles and making skateboards out of them. And punk rock was completely different in America than it was in Britain. And I think the reason punk rock has continued to be so vibrant and interesting and diverse is because America had a totally different take on it. And, you know, Nervous Breakdown, it's before their debut album, and it's probably the sound of people who just needed to get into a studio. It didn't have to be a 48-track studio, and get down what was on their mind. And it's sonically, this is a mess. This is a brilliant mess. It's very very dynamic. It's thrilling. I always get a thrill. And the other thing about punk rock in America, it was about the mental landscape. I think far more than punk in Britain or any other country had touched on. It was about how people felt, not just, oh, I'm a bit sad or I'm a bit angry. It was really, really penetrating people's psychologies. I think this is a fantastic single. And it's really interesting that this is 1979. It's quite early in, you know, the 45-year history of punk. Yeah. Well, what do you think of it, Noel?
Yeah, it's again, when we were thinking of the year, Black Flag didn't come to my mind for this year initially. You know, I think they're an amazing band, and I think, you know, they really kickstarted something in US hardcore, you know. Like again, their early days, it was shambolic, it was a mess as well, and the gigs all had trouble, didn't they? And there was trouble following them around. But they always seemed to manage to find a way, and it was their work ethic. You know, I'm amazed by their work ethic. Kind of like what you're hinting at, you know, it's a very interesting business story, isn't it? You know, SST Records, and it's all about, you know, it's kind of like the Minutemen as well. You know, they just get in the van, they go and they do it, and they work and they just keep going. And Black Flag with Keith Morris singing, you know, it's before Dez, it's before Rollins, and they're the people who get, you know, a lot of the kudos. But you know, they were a good, strong band even then. And I think your point there, it's like this kind of, they needed to get into the studio, they needed to release this energy, and it was some energy that was being released.
Yeah, there's no fat on that, to use a horrible term. There's nothing that shouldn't be there. Like it's fantastic, and it's vibrant, and it's pulsating. But I do think it's important that, you know, Americans probably talked about feelings more, or there was more of a national conversation. Yeah. That it's taken 35 years to become culturally acceptable over on this side of the Atlantic. And, you know, to me, this is in a tradition along with Suicidal Tendencies, Institutionalized. Like these songs that you think, God, that's really raw. That's really, the lyrics are hardcore, the feelings are hardcore, and the music is hardcore. And, you know, people who think, oh, punk rock is just a bunch of people shouting, that there's a lot to this song, and they did it themselves, and there was no touring circuit. Like they had to work, and your point is very, very important. They worked so hard for so little, for so long. And I don't think those early punk bands got adequately rewarded for what they did culturally, for all the music that was inspired, all the young people that were inspired by this, some of whom went on to sell millions of records. But this is the sound of something very exciting happening.
Yeah, you know, we've been playing the last couple of years, and there's bands that are emerging that are influencing other bands musically. Yeah, definitely. The Clash are telling people, get out and form your own band, you know, or ATV are saying, here's a couple of chords, now do it yourself. But Black Flag are talking about a lifestyle as well. You know, it's not just, yeah, anyone can be in a band. It's like, yeah, we're bringing out records. This is the way it's going to be. We're putting on gigs. We're going to start doing things ourselves. Like, really, we're taking over the means of control, and we're really going somewhere with it, which I think was hugely important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. That was Black Flag, Nervous Breakdown. Up next, from their album Cut, which came out in 1979, it's The Slits with Typical Girls.
Thank you.
Yeah, Typical Girls by the Slits. You know, considering they were on that first tour with the Clash, they were on two tours with the Clash from so they were gone since 76. Unlike a lot of other bands who were really prolific, who were bringing out albums, you know, within their first year, the Slits did wait a couple of years before their first album. I was actually looking it up during the week, and the 7-inch, this Typical Girl 7-inch, got to number 60 in the charts, which is kind of low enough when you think of what other songs were. And we mentioned last week about Top of the Pops and all these bands getting on the Top of the Pops. So it's low enough considering. But when you think of the influence that the Slits subsequently had, you know, it's interesting that, you know, it only reached number 60. Because that album, you know, you read about it and people are, you know, it's mentioned many ways that it's one of the defining releases of the post-punk. You know, there's the post-punk sound starting to emerge. Slits have been gone a couple of years. Like, that song sounds like about three songs, you know, in one. But it's creating something different now, you know. It's kind of gone off now. And yeah, we'll throw this verse in. We'll throw this little, you know, bit of reggae or whatever in. It's a pop song underneath it all, you know. So I find them a fascinating band.
I totally agree with the end. We had the 12-inch single. So, it seemed like a solid investment. You know, it was a big artifact. But I completely agree with you, Niall, about it doesn't sound like one song. I think it sounds like more than three. It sounds like, you know, just this whole roller coaster of ideas been chucked in together, and it didn't matter what flew off, what made it to the end. It's a brilliantly inventive. I'm amazed that it got as high as number 60, because it doesn't sound like punk rock. I think Lydon it's quite right that he gets credit for making punk into post-punk by ripping it apart. But to me, all of the elements, you mentioned this as a post-punk single, all the elements of post-punk are in here for me. And the fact that it's women singing about marketing ploys, singing about typical girls, typical boys, consumerism. This isn't what women did. Even some of the brilliant folk artists or the artists out of psychedelia in the 60s, or even some of the great Motown singers who weren't afraid to touch on social issues, they all were in some way constrained by the fact that they were singing pop music. Whereas there's nothing constrained about the Slits. It just sounds so freeform. I think it's one of the great singles of all time. And I still don't know what time signature it is. I don't know. I couldn't even describe this adequately, except that it was a complete breath of fresh air, and it was thrilling and it was exciting. And it wasn't something that, in my experience, I'd ever heard women do.
Yeah. Yeah, as you say, complete breath of fresh air, and so different to what we played previously with Black Flag. But again, it's just all these new ideas starting to emerge and people going, yeah, we can do this with music. And whether it was men or women in the band, it didn't matter. But of course it did, because it's harder for women, and there was so few women in bands up till then. And the Slits were, you know, coming out and voicing. They weren't holding anything back. It was great.
Yeah, absolutely. Uncompromised pop music. And that means that it's inspiring for all time.
Yeah, fantastic. Not too far away, I suppose, up next is Penetration. Shout Above the Noise. So we'll play Penetration, and we'll just have a little chat about them after that. We'll be right back. So that's Shout Above the Noise by Penetration. Now, Michael, I remember we saw Penetration a few years ago at Rebellion, and you were very excited by the fact that they were on stage and very excited by the chance to get to see them. And that's one thing I know we've spoken about Rebellion as well, that like here you are, you're getting a chance to see these bands that maybe you wouldn't have had a chance. But I got a compilation CD during the week called Loud Women. It's the third volume of CDs in this series, and that song could well have been on that CD. You know, a CD just released this week. You know, a compilation album out this week, and that song to me, you know, it still sounds as fresh. It still sounds, you know, as important and as relevant. You know, don't let them win. Don't let them drag you in. Shout above the noise. Like, get out there and speak your mind. Great choice.
Yeah, and this wasn't even a single. Like, that's how good this band were. That this wasn't even a single. I think Pauline Murray, what a vocalist. What? And to me, this is punk rock, you know, inverted commas, not too far away from rock music. But what rock band in this era had a singer like Pauline Murray, had some female role model who had that type of attitude, that type of worldview, as you said, that type of rallying call saying, you know, don't accept the way things are. Robert Blamire, I think, was a brilliant musician. And, you know, just the combination of her voice, the lyrics and the sound just make this a thrilling song. And I didn't get to see them first time round. And I'm always a bit worried about seeing my heroes, you know, years after they've released the records that maybe meant a lot to me at a moment in my life. But they were sensational live. You know, they've still got so much energy and dynamism. And if you put a different guitar sound over this record, you've got most of the elements of Big Country, who then go on to, you know, be huge on both sides of the Atlantic. And I think Penetration are one of the great should have been of this era. You know, they should have been a huge band, and they weren't. But my God, they left such a legacy.
Yeah. I think because of that, obviously, yeah, the legacy, that's why we have them in here. I think it's very important, and it's great that, you know, they're in here and recognized, you know, it as the top 10 of 1979. Yeah. Okay, so up next, I kind of cheated a little bit with this next song because it's Stiff Little Fingers. The album came out in 79, but they did bring out the single in 78. Suspect Device as a single, but it was released on Rigid Digits initially, and there was only about 500 in the first pressing. So because of that, I'm allowing it into 1979, and I have the playlist here in front of me, so we can go for that. So this is Suspect Device, Stiff Little Fingers.
Power!
Oh, I love it. I love it. I'm nearly as tired now sitting in the chair singing along to that song with my waving my hand in the air as I was back in the early 80s in the local school disco, jumping up and down to Stiff Little Fingers and being excited and energized by their music. And it was like, you know, the only time we danced was this and maybe a jam song as well, you know, or maybe Secret Affair even, because it was, you know, it got going a little bit. But every week, Suspect Device managed to get on somehow because, you know, you kind of knew someone who knew the DJ and they played it. And I'm brought back to that era. I also just listening to it there, and I kind of forgot that the whole song didn't have a skip in the middle of it because there was a little skip in my record. And I'm hearing it the full way now, which is probably the first time I've heard it the full way in a long time, probably since back in the 80s. But like what I loved about Stiff Little Fingers, Michael, was, you know, we spoke about Dublin before, you know, and Grey Streets of Dublin in the 70s and us not getting away. You know, when you went to Futurama, we talked about you went to Futurama Festival and it was your first time out of the country. You know, Belfast, Northern Ireland, 100 miles up the road, the border was a lot less, but yeah, it was a world apart. And we were brought up like nearly, oh, don't talk to people from Northern Ireland. You're going to get shot. You know, you're going to get bombed. And this was like, hang on, they don't seem to be on one side or the other side. They seem to be saying, question everything you're told. You know, why can't we take over and try to put things right? It wasn't about killing. It wasn't about bombing people. It wasn't about bitterness. It was about trying to, you know, cut through that, but there was still an anger there and still a rawness. So it wasn't ignoring what was happening. It was going, yeah, this is happening, and you know it sucks. And they just really spoke to me as a band. So I had to get Suspect Device in there. I had to do a little bit of a maneuvering around because the single did come out late 78. You know, and John Peel championed it, and then suddenly it took off, and the album was 79. But like, just it's just so powerful.
Yeah, I agree, and the power, you can still feel that power. And I'm like you, I can't sit still when I hear that song, you know. So some part of me is moving, but that album that it's from, you know, the catalog number alone is the reason to buy it. Catalog number is Rough One. This is the first album on Rough Trade,
yeah,
and it's from Ireland, so. That's a milestone. That's saying that punk isn't about London or New York or LA. That's saying punk is about Belfast. And this would be a brilliant single, even if you were saying, I was walking down the road and I fell over and I hurt myself. You know, it would be a brilliant song if it was about nothing. Because what does the guitarist do? It rips your head off. Job done. What does the singer sound like? The singer sounds like he will sing the song as though his life depends on it, even if it means he can never sing another note again. And musically, this is a band that are capable of some of the best rock music, and, you know, include all of the rock bands from AC/DC to ZZ Top in there. Stiff Little Fingers compete in the world of rock music as well. And then you've got these lyrics, and there's sure this controversy that, you know, their manager helping with the lyrics. Who cares?
Yeah,
They're making a statement. They're saying, this is where we live, this is what we see, but we don't have any solutions. We're not saying pick a side. It's a fantastic document of the time. It's not even 3 minutes, but it feels like a whole rock opera, even though that's not a very nice thing.
A punk rock opera, maybe the first punk rock opera.
Yeah, I think that there's so much going on in there, but this is one of the greatest songs of all time. It's certainly one of the greatest punk songs, but Stiff Little Fingers went on to write even better singles.
Mm.
You know, that's incredible. They should have stopped after this first album, but they didn't. They wrote better songs, which to me is a real testament. And that's not to throw shade on this, because this is a masterpiece. But I think it's thrilling in every way.
Yeah, brilliant. It's brilliant. Okay, I'll take a breath. I'm almost breathless even talking about it. It just really captures it for me. So we move on. Cabaret Voltaire next. Nag, nag, nag. So we play it, and again, we'll have a little chat about it. We'll be right back. So Nag 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 was a single released in 79, Cabaret Voltaire. I'm not sure if the single was on Rough Trade, but certainly their album was, wasn't it, that year?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, another Rough Trade band. And this isn't punk rock, if you think that punk rock is just four lads, you know, shouting football terrorist chants and ranting about the world. But to me, this is completely the essence of why this moment in music was so thrilling. It doesn't sound like punk rock, but it was very, very part, very much part of saying we can do anything. Mm-hmm. And to me, a guitar is quite a complicated instrument to play. I don't think everyone can pick up a guitar and play. I certainly can't. But with this early electronic sound, and when you think of everything that came after this,
yeah.
Now, I know Suicide were doing something along these lines in terms of instruments before, but for this to be the sound of Sheffield at a time when people were looking for the next Flash or Sex Pistols or the next generic punk band, this allowed a whole load of creative people to think that there were lots of, almost an infinite number of ways to express yourself. If you had a bit of attitude, if you had something to say or something to do. And this allowed a whole load of not musicians, but creative people. In Dublin, obviously, we had Steve Avril, who had the Radiators, and then he goes down into electronic music, I think, you know, somewhat, maybe not as aggressive as Cabaret Voltaire, but following that same impulse and also the same technological possibilities of, oh, you can buy a synthesizer in a music shop now, and it's not too expensive. So to me, that this is one of the reasons that this single and this band, why punk rock and post-punk just continue to be exciting and breaking boundaries.
Yeah.
Now, this was my choice. Would this have been on your radar at all, Niall, or does this seem out of place?
Well, funny, does it seem out of place? It wouldn't have really been on my radar. It wouldn't have been something that I was listening to at the time or you know, the following few years. I don't know why. I think Joe Strummer might have said something about a synthesizer somewhere along the way. And so I went, if a band has keyboards, I don't need to listen to them. I have enough bands with guitars that I can listen to. But I've since, you know, in more recent years, gone back and listened to bands like this. And again, you know, it's the influence that they've had, which to me is the fascinating part, because it's at this stage, you know, where bands are starting to play their own music and go, yeah, we can do it. That to me is the punk rock influence. I know there was stuff going on before that, but that to me is the real punk rock influence. We can be in a band. And like you say, Cabaret Voltaire going, yeah, but you know, we want to mess around with instruments. You know, we want to make it a little bit difficult maybe for you to listen to, or we don't care if it's difficult for you to listen to. This is what we want to do, which to me, that's the ultimate really in punk bands. And then it's the influence that they had on a genre of music. But I will admit, it's not a genre of music that I then started listening to. I was too busy listening to the next band that we're going to play, probably to be, you know, from Leeds rather than Sheffield, you know, so that part of Yorkshire I was in. But, you know, when you think of the influence and the direction that they were able to take something in, to me, that's the really interesting part about this.
And do you remember the first time or the first few times that you would have listened to Big Black?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And to me, this is that same sensation, that same sense of, I can't believe they're doing this, and it's so powerful and exciting, but I still think it's a bit scary. To me, this is that in 1979. So right. you can imagine how what that sounded like on a record player in Dean's Grange.
Brilliant. Yeah, and would have sounded like if maybe my brothers had brought it home to me in Donegarney. Who knows? but it passed us by. But I would certainly, I'm glad that it's in there because it's very important. All right, well, we'll move over to Leeds then, will we? Okay, we've gone Sheffield as Cabaret Voltaire. We spoke a bit about the Leeds scene last week, but this is Gang of Four at home. He's a Tourist. Michael, so Gang of Four at home, he's a Tourist. So we spoke about post-punk. We've referenced it, but you know, we have to have Gang of Four in there if we're talking post-punk, I think. It's just classic. It's stripped down, it's bare, it's punk rock. It's challenging to listen to in parts, which is what I like. It's a band doing what they want. But again, you know, it is the guitar, bass, drums, the bass line at the start of that just kicks in and it goes on. And then the bass drum and the cymbals come in and then the guitar starts scraping. To me at that stage, I was like, yeah, you know, I've been listening to punk. I've been listening to all that punk sound. And here we go. This is a really interesting direction we're going in with music. And, you know, we mentioned the Mekons last week and a Gang of Four this week. What they're doing, you know, was taking it in a slightly different direction at that stage. we spoke about Top of the Pops as well. Gang of Four could have played that song on Top of the Pops. BBC asked them to change the lyrics. They said no, so they didn't play. They didn't get on Top of the Pops. The song got banned because it mentions rubbers. It's just great. And that whole album is brilliant. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago about a tape that I had in work. And on one side of the tape was Gang of Four Entertainment. And it just got worn away. It was played so much.
Even the cover of this album is important and interesting and thrilling to look at. And, you know, again, if I'm thinking with my punk rock radar on, does the guitar rip the top of your head off? Check. Yes, it does. Does the singer sound like he will sing this song even if it hurts him? Yes. I mean, what other song do you know that got near the charts that mentioned ulcers? I don't think I'd ever even heard someone mention ulcers.
Yeah.
You know, in my life before I heard, you know, this young guy singing about ulcers and anxiety and consumption. And your Top of the Pops point is important because people, the authorities at Top of the Pops objected to the word rubber in the song. Yet when you think of the sleaze that was going on and, you know, this little subtext of sexualization of younger people, to me, you know, Gang of Four were certainly on the right side of that argument that society wasn't even really thinking about at that moment. Yeah. But bands like the Gang of Four, like the Slits, like Penetration, you know, they were very, very conscious. And I think anyone who experienced punk rock and took it seriously early on was very, very fortunate because you were told not to accept what you were being told. You were told not to accept mainstream thinking. You were told to reject homophobia, ageism, sexism, racism. That was an incredible gift to get as a young person from a music that made you feel good and was artistic and creative as well, but had this really, really important foundation. And Gang of Four, to me, are one of the best examples of very, very conscious thinking in a band. And with something to say, a way to say it that was innovative and interesting and new, and one of the great bands. Yeah. One of the great bands. And I love that then they go on to be part of, you know, from the Gang of Four, you get the producer of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, you know, and with all that happened, you know, with Red Hot Chili Peppers in terms of bringing their music to the world, that even people from bands that weren't superstars, that never got to play huge gigs, that they were absolutely part of the supportive environment that gave bands a leg up, and some of them went on to sell millions of records. So important for so many reasons. But Noel, isn't it just great to listen to?
Well, that's it. Yeah. You know, the songs are much bigger than just actual songs, but when you just put them on, they're still brilliant though. That's, yeah, great to listen to. Okay, Michael, we move on now to next song, and it's Playground Twist from Susie and the Banshees, 7-inch released in 1979. So Playground Twist there from Susie, from the Soundscape album, 1979. And to me, it's almost like chalk and cheese to Gang of Four, isn't it, that we just played before that? You know, Gang of Four is kind of bare, raw, stripped down kind of music with the guitars, kind of angular guitars. And this Susie is like a soundscape of noise, isn't it? You know, so, but it still has that pounding drums, and it's still, you know, maybe it's a post-punk sound or whatever, but it's just a complete contrast to Gang of Four.
Yeah, and even a complete contrast to what Susie and the Banshees had been 12 months previously, and certainly what they had been, you know, by all accounts, when she did that 100 Club Festival doing the Lord's Prayer. And I think that Susie and the Banshees are a brilliant band, but they don't get enough credit for how creative they were and how they took that original impulse of punk. You know, these were some of the people who were the first, you know, human beings to latch on to the Sex Pistols and think, that's really exciting. That's a thrilling way to dress and to look and almost to perform, you know, a bit of theatre every single time you went outside your front door. You were on stage. And that would have been enough in terms of a cultural contribution. But the fact that then Susie Sue, you know, lots of her songs are very dreamlike to me. They're very nightmare-like as well. And, you know, Freud and the psychoanalysis people would have had so much fun, you know, examining, you know, what's really been said here. But to take this darkness, to take this theatrical darkness, to take nightmares and images of children in a playground and turn that, twist it, as the song title goes, into something really, really interesting and dark, but within a 3-minute-ish pop song and a really brilliant sounding pop song, I think make Susie and the Banshees one of the great bands to have come out of popular music in any time, anywhere.
Mm. Well, it's the second song from them that we've had so far in the couple of years. Would I be right in saying that Budgie played with on the Slits album as well? So he's drumming on both of these, with Susie and the Slits. I think Budgie played on that Slits album. So
yeah, he's on that, on the Slits album. And you know, I'm not a musician, so I don't know how to judge a drummer. But I just know how it feels like to listen to a song that Budgie plays on. And the rhythm is so strong that you get pulled in, you know, without even identifying, oh, what a great drummer, in the way that maybe you'd look at some virtuoso drummer in some kind of prog rock band. But for him to be able to do this in a pop context, I think it's a really, really mark of someone who's creatively incredibly strong. I love this. I don't just love the lyrics of Susie. I don't just love the way they look. I love the sound. In fact, I'd love an album of instrumentals by them. You know, I think the music is that good.
Yeah.
And that's not to take away from her, because I adore her as a vocalist. As a pop vocalist.
Yeah.
I think, you know, look at what 79 has brought us now already. Look at from Cabaret Voltaire to Stiff Little Fingers, Penetration, the Slits, Gang of Four, and Susie's in there on top of the Pops.
Yeah.
And then
played live on top of the Pops, that was. Yeah.
And then across the Atlantic, you've got these punk rock scientists, punk rock obsessives who aren't satisfied making a racket and having their friends over. You know, with Black Flag, they've got Ratman, their sound guy. He built a PA for every tour they went on. So they sounded really good. They might have been sleeping on people's bedrooms. They might have had no money for decent food on the road, but they were spreading the idea of punk rock with a very, very good handle on technology, as well as enterprise and organization. Yeah. So 79 to me is the year that punk rock breaks free of every single limitation that anyone imposed on it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's really brewing up to something interesting, isn't it? We might be taking it back a step or two with the next song, but it's still a great song, and it's such a tuneful song, and it's so catchy. Members are up next with Sound of the Suburbs. Sound of the Suburbs there, the members, a real kind of, I don't know, a blast of fresh air maybe, but it's the sound of people starting bands in their bedrooms all over the country. That's what that is to me. I love that, you know, they're describing the bands of the year, you know, drums are quite good. Imagine like that's a line in the song. Oh yeah, the drums are quite good. The bass is too loud and I can't hear a word. This is the sound. So that's, they're kind of saying, yeah, this is what's coming up. This is what's appearing now. You know, we played Champ 69 last week and we spoke about, you know, 78, they were starting and people were in working class areas or whatever, people in the suburbs were going, yeah, we can be in a band. And to me, that's what the members were doing. It's like, yeah, yeah, anyone can start a band. This is the sound. They're not saying it's brilliant. It's just the sound of the suburbs. And, you know, there's better songs on the list tonight. There's more going on. There's more tuneful songs. There's more happening musically and inventive songs. But, you know, to me, it's a sound of the era. It's a song of that era.
Yeah, I love this song, Niall. I think it's a brilliant pop song. And to me, the members kind of follow on from the Damned in being punky and having a bit of attitude, but also having a great sense of humor. To me, this is a really, really brilliantly funny song. And again, when people look back at punk, they think, oh, it was anti-society, it was anti-this, it was anti-that, but it was pro-fun. It was really pro youthful expression. A couple of things about the members, I think, that are fascinating. One, this goes top 20 in Ireland. You know, yeah, Ireland is a place where Joe Dolan, Big Tom and Dana rule the charts, Margot. So for this to be top 20 in Ireland at the start, very early in 79, that was thrilling to me. As a young person interested in music, I think the sound of suburbs, it is a great sound. Steve Lillywhite, the producer, he was the drummer's brother. And, you know, he goes on to be one of the most important producers, but never forgot his punk roots. He even recently, he's spoken really highly about his favorite punk songs and about the energy that got him in there. So, again, I think the sound of punk was often the sound of young engineers, young producers who really thought that these young bands deserved to sound as good as they could under the circumstances. So I love the sound of this. It's classic pop sound. And I also love the sleeve. If you bought punk or whatever it's called, singles at the time, you know, you studied everything. I wasn't aware that I was studying the colors, but you're soaking that up. That's going into your perception of your experience of this single that you've taken, hopefully you've paid for it, in a shop and you've brought home and now you own it. It's part of your collection of things. And the sleeve on this, I think, was great with the television and the kind of the light blue circles. And it was one of the early designs from Assorted Images, which was Malcolm Garrett, who did the Buzzcocks before this. He did Magazine. He did the Yachts. And he later goes on to do Duran Duran and Simple Minds when both of those are huge. So I think not only did some of these singles sound brilliant, but their packaging was innovative and interesting. And compare this, it's the same era, with the absolute diabolical, disgusting, pathetic sleeve that wraps up the equally pathetic and crap single from the Knack, My Sharona. So I think that in Britain, the early bands of this movement were also bringing this really, really cool design aesthetic in there. But then the intelligent bands in the States, like Black Flag, picked up on.
Yeah.
That their sleeves were little pieces of industrial art that were well worth looking at closely and, you know, deserved to be on the walls of galleries. And
yeah,
some of them are now.
Great. Yeah, we didn't mention it with Black Flag, with Raymond Pettibon and the artwork that he did and went on to produce, you know, so many more things, and those flyers as well, those Black Flag flyers. You make a great point there. Like, we say anyone can join a band, but it's like, okay, it's more difficult for anyone to be a graphic designer, but suddenly there was an avenue now for people who were interested in design to get out, and whether that was cut and paste and whether it was using their bits of glue or whatever back then. And then, as you say, there's a chance for people to produce stuff that maybe wouldn't have had the chance, and they can go in and they can help out and they can learn the production, or they can learn whatever. So it wasn't just that anyone can be in a band. It's the whole thing that goes around with it as well, which is, yeah, that's a very interesting point.
Yeah, so you might throw shade at this song, but
well, this song was a great song for my kids growing up as well. It was a great one to put on in the car, you know, a great sing-along track to put on in the car. I was just kind of saying, you know, compared to some of the other more musical endeavors that we had played previous, you know, it wasn't the same, but yeah, it's sure it's probably been played more in my house than Susie has in the last 10 years as well, right? Though, but you know,
I'm just having a go with you. I fully like what you're saying.
Yeah, okay, so we're going stateside next. We've two songs left, stateside for both of them. Up next is California Uber Allies, Dead Candies. What a song, Michael. Jerry Brown didn't quite make president.
But what a debut song.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. First single.
Imagine that's your first single now.
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
And to me, this is such a strange song because it's funny now. It's hilariously funny. And it's not attacking the people that punk songs are meant to attack. And, you know, I didn't know who Jerry Brown was. Did I know that California had a governor? Probably not. But I took such a dislike to this man based on this song without knowing anything about him. And then later in life, I realized, well, he wasn't some right winger. Like, this was a liberal progressive guy. And, you know, the song in there about kids will meditate in school, you know, and what's going on with wellness? What's going on with the idea that you need to give kids a pause?
Yeah, is that bad?
Exactly. So it was a prophecy that was this very, very acid humor with loads of now very, very emotionally touchy, almost forbidden topics, you know, Holocaust imagery in there. This was an incredible, I think this is an incredible piece of art. Never mind an amazing song. I think the sound is perfect for the lyrics, because it's, you know, there's moments where the guitar almost makes me laugh, but then there's moments where I think this is one of the most terrifying things you can do with six strings. This is impossibly aggressive guitar. Yeah. So I remember the first time I heard this song. Again, the artwork is fantastic in keeping with it, but there's a whole lot of, I think, wasn't it Michael Stewart Foley's brilliant book about the Dead Kennedys debut album, you know, put in the context of this kind of merry pranksters in California, this very, over here we had it with the Virgin Prunes, you know, where theater and music could be mixed to be something that was very, very aggressive. Yeah. It wasn't pleasant. It wasn't meant to make you comfortable.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting for me that we're going this kind of nearly chronological. It's not, you know, months of the year, but from 76, 77, 78, 79. There's a slight turn now in the music, you know. You had the speed of the Ramones. Now you have the speed, but there's a menace in there, isn't there, you know, to that sound, like Black Flag there. It's this thing is starting to emerge. It's starting to evolve. And the Dead Kennedys are out there, you know, like... It's theater and it's menacing and it's fun, you know, all in one. And, you know, as they evolve then, and the artwork around their albums, the albums become more than just a collection of songs. It's what they're standing for. It's what the lyrics are saying. It's what the artwork is in. It's about, you know, ultimately it becomes No More Censorship and all. There's a huge history there, you know. But as a debut single, what a starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what you're saying about the artwork and Winston Smith and the cartoons, but, you know, unlike the Pettibone stuff with Black Flag, you know, I'm thinking of Bedtime for Democracy in particular, you know, double sleeve, and there's so many little characters and you're looking at them wondering, oh, you know, that's funny, but God, that bit there is scary. And then you later see it come out in a bit more of a playful way with Green Day and Dookie, although that's an explosion as well. But you probably spent hours, Niall, looking at Crass album artwork and Flux artwork and the Dead Kennedys and the seriousness of Crass and Flux was echoed with the Dead Kennedys, but then there was this playful thing, and to me it made it even more unsettling, because you're thinking, oh, why would I find that funny when look what's happening in this other part of this inverted commas cartoon. So I think that Dead Kennedys are an incredible band, but I'd love to know more about your point about the menace. Would we be looking back 45 years later and thinking that the Clash sound and the Sex Pistols sounded very menacing? Which I find them aggressive, but not menacing. But if hardcore hadn't come along in America, would music have kept getting more and more intense and short? Now, obviously, heavy metal's in a different direction, but...
Yeah,
this American sound made everything else sound a light.
Yeah, it did. Except there was some of it with bands like, say, Theatre of Hate, you know, and you know, some would say the post-punk stuff, or even Susie as well, you know, there was a certain unsettling, you know, feature. But this had that plus speed. So it was like, you know, challenging it at times to listen to, well, Dead Kennedys maybe not so, because underneath it all, they're really tuneful songs, aren't they? They're just played with speed, but with that added kind of edge, you know. So they kind of mixed they're challenging you, you know, with their sound, which I think is what was happening as well with Theatre of Hate or bands like that. They were challenging you and Susie, but the challenge then added to the speed, added to a message that's going on, added to the theatre of Jello as well, you know, on stage or even in songs. And like you say there, the song kind of stops halfway and it's kind of almost like a show tune or something like that, you know, and then suddenly it's bang straight back in. But yeah, like hardcore kind of, you know, and it's starting here, it takes it to a different level, doesn't it? You know, like, because gigs, you know, back then there was violence everywhere, but the songs didn't sound that violent. But you get to the Dead Kennedys and there's the speed and the violence almost coming through, you know. And I think it's, you know, it's starting to take a turn now, and that's, you know, hardcore emerging, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that debut album was top 40 in Britain.
Yeah.
You know, if you go down the top 40 of the last 10 or 20 years, is there a more threatening album in there than this, you know, debut from this band of kind of merry pranksters in terms of Jello and the stage persona?
But even their name, the Dead Kennedys, you know, like that alone, even at that stage, especially in Ireland as well, because the Kennedys were revered, weren't they? You know, but that name, you know, like the Sex Pistols sure was a shocking name, but, you know, something like the Dead Kennedys was a record I was hiding from my dad.
Yeah, absolutely incredible at the time, and then incredible where they went after.
Yeah. Well, the next song is one that I wasn't hiding from my dad. I think my dad was probably singing along to it. We'll play it. We'll have a chat. I know we had a conversation about whether it should be in here or not. So this is a bit different to the Dead Kennedys. This is the Dickies with Banana Splits. I'm gonna banana splits. Yeah, so in our discussions about this show, this came up, whether we should include this or not. I had this down, you know, we pick five songs each, as I said earlier, and I had this down in my five. Believe it or not, I was picking between this and The Germs. I've certainly listened to The Germs a lot more than I've listened to The Dickies. And I would, as a band, I think The Germs are a better band than The Dickies. But having said that, this was really the first pop punk band, like the Ramones, sure, yeah, with that sound. But this was your first like real pop punk in that way. This, you know, these are a definite influence on bands like Green Day or bands like the Toy Dolls, or, you know, it's that sound that was evolving. It's a sound I don't think we can ignore and we shouldn't ignore. It's a great song. It's a great 7-inch. It's a great piece of art as well. And they were excellent musicians, but they were jokers. But it was still a facet of punk rock that was starting to appear. They're from the same state. They're from Jerry Brown's state as well. He's the same governor, but they certainly weren't singing about him. But, you know, they had some interesting stuff going on. So that's how they got my vote, and that's how I was advocating for them.
No, and I was delighted when they appeared on your top five, because they wouldn't have been close to mine. And yet my memory is that they were very, very important. This single in particular, in terms of the music landscape, in terms of people who were probably listening to Breakfast in America as well, and they thought, oh, that's really funny, and it's Yellow Vinyl, and maybe it got them into punk rock. Maybe it put them off punk rock for life. But this, as you say, I think you can draw a line from the Ramones to the Dickies. And to me, the Dickies were the Ramones if they were wearing, you know, car seat covers, like like the Damned War. It was funny. It was actually hilarious. And it was this speedy, peppy. This was music for a mosh pit. Maybe before mosh pits had even entered the public consciousness. And it goes top 10.
Yeah.
In Britain. The album is it's top 20. So this was absolutely saying, you know what? Whatever you think punk is, it can be great fun. And to me, this is the sound that really came into the mainstream with the Warp Festival, with Me First and the Gimme Gimmes, where I love seeing punk bands taking songs that are either not meant to be taken seriously or are meant to be kind of the holy grail. Oh, you couldn't touch Black Sabbath. And run it through that your clownish punk rock machine.
Yeah.
And yes, you can. You can, with punk rock, you can do absolutely everything. And this is a perfect example.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure we get a bit of stick because they're in there, you know, a lot of people won't have them in their top 10 songs of 1979, but they certainly have a place. Well, that's them all.
A nice end on a piece of yellow vinyl, banana colored vinyl.
Yellow vinyl and a nice bit of fun as well. Yeah. Okay.
That was brilliant, Noel. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. That was 1979. We'll get back into the boxing ring and we'll sort out 1980 before next week.
That's the decade. The decade's gone now, the 70s. They're over.
Yeah.
Kind of sad.
70s are over, and you see a sound evolving even through those songs that we played. But yeah, it is sad, isn't it? 70s are over. And maybe there's a bit of color starting to appear in the 1980s. But
but the color might be yellow and it might be banana flavored.
Exactly.
Yeah, let's see what happens.
Excellent. All right, Michael. Thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
Thanks very much. All the best.